Thank you for listening to this Podcast One production. Now available on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, PodcastOne.com, and anywhere else you get your podcasts.
Quick break to tell you guys about NFL Game Pass, the only way that you can replay every game all season long. You can relive all the gutsy calls, crazy catches, wild comebacks, and breakout stars from every game every week. It's all the action, all the football you can handle, all in one place. So every game that we're talking about right now, you guys can rewatch it after the fact. I'm going to be going back, and you guys can too. Go check out Lamar Jackson in week one. Go check out Dak Prescott and what that Cowboys offense actually did. Go check out Kyler Murray and his NFL debut. That's my favorite thing about NFL Game Pass. You can go back and watch at any time. And if you haven't watched a condensed game yet, you have to try it out. It's every play from the game back to back to back, so you can replay an entire NFL game in the fraction of the time it normally takes. It's how I'm able to follow all the MVP candidates, all the breakout stars, and, of course, your waiver wire pickups all season long. To see all the action this season and stay on top of all the big storylines, you need NFL Game Pass. Best of all, you can kick off the 2019 NFL season with a 7-day free trial of NFL Game Pass. Just sign up now at NFL.com/ProFootballFocusNFL. Welcome in to the PFF NFL podcast. Steve Pelizzolo here with Sam Monson. We're back from Miami and we're talking all things Super Bowl and more on this show. We're going to talk draft too.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. All right. People want to hear about Chiefs 49ers and our take and the recap. We got to look forward as well. We'll do a little bit of draft. What else are we doing today?
Draft, and we'll talk a little bit about the awards. NFL did their honors thing. They gave their awards out. Let's compare them to ours and see where we land.
Okay. Awesome. This is an action-packed show. Can we do it under 3 hours? It's going to be about 3 hours.
Sure.
It's going to be a long show, I think.
The last one was shorter, though, right?
We'll see.
I didn't even know. How much did it end up being once we stitched together all the...
It was a little over an hour.
Yeah.
Jeff Schwartz.
So we owe the people an hour.
We got a lot of good feedback on our Jeff Schwartz and Greg Cosell interviews. I thought... We've done a few interviews through the years. I thought it was our best, the best interviews, the best insightful football discussion we've ever had. So I enjoyed those both of those guys a lot on the last podcast. I suggest you go back and listen to actually the Jeff Schwartz and Greg Cosell. We might repackage that Greg Cosell bit because we talked about QB evaluation quite a bit. It wasn't just the game preview. So a lot of good stuff on that Thursday pod that came out on Friday. How was your week in Miami, man?
It's pretty good. Pretty good.
Yeah. Your first time at the Super Bowl.
It was.
We talked about it a little bit the other day, but there was just a lot going on.
First time in Miami as well.
Yeah, for me as well.
Really?
I had never been to Miami, no.
You've been like everywhere.
I know.
You spent your entire life moving to cities.
And I'd never been that far south.
Playing baseball.
In Florida.
You've never been to Miami.
No. Huh. I've been to Puerto Rico.
Right. You've been to Puerto Rico. You haven't been to Miami.
Yeah.
Okay.
So how would you, for the listeners here, how would you describe Super Bowl week through our lens from we're there for the media, Radio Row, and how, you know, what we're trying to do down there.
Yeah, fairly chaotic. Radio Row is this giant aircraft hangar of a building or a room, just stacked tables like this, right? Everyone's just set up one after the other, rows of them as far as the eye can see.
Yeah, Radio Row is really Radio Rows. There's
yes,
many rows.
Many rows. And then in the middle, you've got the sort of bigger sets, right? For the national, the TV guys and the big serious type national broadcast stuff. They get a bit more of a fancy setup and a bit more space. Your Boston guys seem to weirdly just like they took their desk and parked it next to the fancy ones.
Well, so they're part of NBC Sports Boston.
Yeah.
So the NBC Sports video crew was there. And so they needed to simulcast it back there. So they're not just like parked randomly. They're being simulcast back into Boston. So they needed to be next to the NBC crew. They're in the NBC section. So they're a part of like the local cable, NBC cable outlet over there. And I did go on that show. I went on Felger and Maz. Noted antagonists.
Yes.
In Boston, and they were being antagonists about our list over at ESPN, our top players list, where we had Mahomes number one and Garoppolo number 17, the best players in the Super Bowl.
I think my favorite thing about the whole week is the comedy photo opportunities for you next to other people, right?
Yeah.
Now, I got a good one of you next to Pete Prisco.
Yeah,
and frankly, so we have one of those already, right? But basically, anytime you two are close, I have the camera at the ready looking for hilarious shots. You know that picture of Derrick Henry standing next to Deion Lewis?
Yeah.
It's like that, right? You and Prisco walking into the conference center. It's amazing. It's beautiful.
Yeah.
That one was a good one, right? I still want to get the one of you and Greg Rosenthal. If we could get you, Greg, and Pete in the same photo frame, that would be beautiful. The other one, this behind-the-scenes
little thing that we're trying to pull together.
Yeah.
We're trying to pull something together. I don't want to give it away, but across multiple NFL podcasts. Let us know what your favorite NFL podcasts are, because we'll try to bring it all together. We're trying to do some things behind the scenes with everybody. Greg could be involved. Pete could be involved.
He could be.
So that could be our chance.
The other photograph I desperately wanted to get was, at one point, you, Shaq, and the Big Show were all in the room at the same time. If I could have got the three of you together and then like a regular human for context purposes, that would have been great.
Yeah, I would have loved to at least get the Big Show.
We really did need a photograph of you, like the stare down, you and the Big Show.
You know who else showed up on Friday before we left or after we left?
No.
Ric Flair.
Oh, I did see him.
Ric Flair's running around and everything.
Yeah.
I'm kind of sad at the missed opportunities last week. Yeah. And.
Oh, tell us about the biggest missed opportunity.
The biggest missed opportunity. So there's stars running around all over the place. And I decided that I allowed myself one little fanboy moment when Big Poppy was running around.
Right.
David Ortiz. You know, because I used to play baseball. I don't know if you know that.
I've heard that.
So Ortiz is running around and I was like, all right, you see Gronk's running around. Like, people are running around left and right. There's people all over the place. Big Show, like you said, Shaq. But I was like, I'm going to go try to get a picture with Big Poppy. So we had it all set up. He had just finished his interview. You came over with me. We were going to get him right when he comes off the stage, grab a picture, tell him, hey, I played minor league baseball. My old teammates, you know, they're buddies with you and all this stuff.
You could have given him your steps of separation.
I'll tell you that in a second. Yeah. Oh, yeah. I've got degrees.
Right.
Couple to him. And then Phil Simms walks by.
Yes.
And ruins everything.
Well, no. So, yeah, we decided that we wanted to get you a photograph with Big Poppy, right? But he was up on like the Yahoo stage doing an interview. So it was like, all right, let's go. We'll stand next to the stage. We'll stand down. We'll wait for him to finish, and then we'll grab him as he comes off, right? Because these guys, they all have handlers that just walk them from like spot to spot to spot to spot. It's stacked up. There's no time for anything.
Right.
So you have to like get in there and grab these people between spots.
And Poppy was doing a good job. He was taking pictures with people and crazy.
So we decided we were going to do that. We're hanging around. He's up there for ages. So we're just loitering, waiting until he's finished. And literally the second he starts packing up his crap to head down off the stage, Phil Simms rounds the corner. It's like, Steve, and the look of despondency in your eyes as you're stuck talking to Phil Simms.
Phil's great, but we had to.
As Big Poppy walks past off into the distance was equal parts hilarious and tragic.
I had no problem catching up with Phil. He's a buddy, but, you know.
But he ruined your day.
I thought it would be more like in and out. And then we started talking a little bit longer before you know it, Poppy's gone.
Yeah.
I really wanted to say to Poppy, because my old roommate knows him, right? My old, I roomed with a Dominican shortstop named Olmo Rosario. So I was going to name drop Olmo.
Okay.
Right. Olmo used to be known as LV Perez. He was one of those guys that came in with a fake name and was saying he was 19. So I really wanted to find out if he knew Olmo as LV or Olmo. That's what I really wanted to know. So I wanted to get a picture with Poppy and say, hey, my old roommate's Olmo Rosario. And he'd be like, who? And then I'd say LV Perez. And he'll say, hey, yeah, I know LV, or vice versa. You know what I mean?
Right.
So my roommate, when he was with Tampa Bay, comes in. This is before I knew him, but he went from 19-year-old LV Perez prospect to, they found out his real name's Olmo Rosario, and he was 24 and no longer a prospect and released.
Yeah.
So
that
his buddies with Poppy.
The Big Poppy thing didn't go well for you. On the other hand, you did manage to crash Good Morning Football on a bike.
I did make it on Good Morning Football.
Yeah.
They didn't have room for me because they got like Christian McCaffrey and Cameron Jordan and real people on there, right? Emmitt Smith. Ooh, big deal. So we went for our bike ride.
Yeah.
And all the sets are right there. And little did I know, we just kind of like stopped to see the set, watch the show. And before you know it, somebody posted a video on social media and there we are in the background.
Yeah. More you than me, obviously.
So that was like my fifth time on Good Morning Football. Four times invited.
Yep.
One time,
you just crashed a set on a bike.
Yeah.
In the background.
That was great.
Yeah.
What a week. Made it on TV a few times.
You did. Most of them not intentional.
I was actually on NFL Network on Tuesday afternoon.
Yes.
And I was ready for the victory lap because I said the key player in the game was going to be Deebo Samuel and they were going to find ways to use him and put him in space and all this stuff. I had my victory lap video ready, pulled from the NFL Network
I liked Andrew Hawkins one, right? Did you see him?
No, what
did he apparently like predicted everything over the course of the week, right? Just changed his take every time and then went, all right, predicted it. All right, now granted I went 16 different ways, but this is the one I definitely meant. So he had one queued up regardless of what happened.
Oh, see,
I think that's genius.
That's what PFT commenter said. He was going to switch his.
Yeah.
We had him on the our little happy hour as well.
So I think we should tease the basketball thing, right? So
okay.
It's very much still in the works at the moment, but we met up with the Tomahawk Show, Joe Thomas and Andrew Hawkins.
Now, yeah.
So we've been talking about how you need to exert your, you know, physical size superiority over the little people.
I talked big game about Joe Thomas.
You did. And then we met him in person. And he's both big and strong and kind of intimidated you.
Yeah, he's kind of jacked. And I think he tried to size me up, stared me down a little bit.
Right. And succeeded because you haven't stopped talking about it since.
Yeah, he's a little stronger than I anticipated. I thought he was, you know, a soft 240 or whatever he is. Now he's
jacked.
He's pretty jacked.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So that's a problem, right?
Well, you gave him a scouting report that you can, you know, get physical and push me around in the post.
I'm trying to use reverse psychology and get you in the right headspace.
No, I feel like
I'm telling you, you can't do it. You're going to be like, no, I can push him around. I weigh him by 40 pounds.
No, I feel like I now need to work on my like 15, 18 foot jumper and more of my mid-range game now.
So you're saying you're mentally weak and you just capitulate once I put a block in front of you.
You just gave him the game plan, though, to stop me. So
because I'm trying to get you to play up to it.
Yeah. Well, I'll be working hard.
Anyway,
starting tomorrow.
So we met those guys, right?
Yeah.
And we obviously brought up the idea of, you know, the 2-on-2 basketball that we're supposed to have. Hawkins took it a step forward and said, what if we created a 2-on-2 tournament, White Man Can't Jump style, that just featured all the NFL podcasts? So us, the Tomahawk Show, the CBS guys, the SI people, all of them, right? Everybody together. Now, obviously, Thomas loved that plan. I think they love the plan because they're going to win whatever happens, right? But we started talking to some of the other podcasts, and I was surprised how many of them were all up for it. So we talked to Will Brinson from CBS.
Yeah.
Now,
Will wants to coach.
Yeah. So Will apparently sucks. So therefore, he's willing to coach and offer up other CBS people that were on their podcast for the purposes. Now, their team ended up being Brady Quinn and Pete Prisco,
yeah,
who apparently can shoot.
Yeah. And he was a center.
What?
I mean, football center.
Oh,
I
mean, that's not that much
center slash really good shooter. And I don't even know if he was a 3-point shooter. I don't know if the 3-point line existed when he played in high school. But apparently he was a good shooter.
At what level of football was he playing?
High school. He was a high school center. Yeah.
Even if he was the size he is now, how did that work?
I don't know, low man wins. Like, who knows what division?
No, the low man doesn't win when he's 125 pounds.
There's a chance his body type changed in 40 years.
What? You think that he was like a jacked 5 foot? What is it?
No, there's like 190 pound centers in high school back then. I mean, the NFL centers were like 240.
When do you think he played?
How old is he?
He's not that old. He wasn't playing in the 60s.
He didn't play in the 50s?
I don't think so. Like, I think he's, you know, we're pretty old, right? I don't think he's that old. Anyway, so
Pete's been around a while.
Brady Quinn and Pete Prisco, I think we could take them. Now, look, you're going to have to step up your game, but if you can't beat Brady Quinn for physicality, then what the hell is the point in
you? Plus, we have a strategy on Brady. I mean, let's just say, maybe he doesn't handle adversity all that well. We could,
I think, between the two of us, we could trash talk him into some mistakes.
I think he's soft.
And then the other thing is,
mentally,
if I can't defend a guy of Pete Prisco's size, then what the hell? I mean, I just need to give up. We also talked to Jessica Smetana, of SI. Her and Charlotte, they're up for it.
Yeah,
they'll play.
They'll be in on the tournament potentially.
We all decided that we could beat the Around the NFL guys. Everybody decided that.
Yeah, I can't imagine.
Regardless of who they put out.
They're not like secret ringers or anything like that. Speaking of the ringer, we'll get some ringer.
That would be bad.
Get some ringer guy, get Kev Clark in there.
Right. If we got embarrassed by them, that would be.
See if Bill Simmons wants to play.
That would be unfortunate. Also, it means we can get all of our podcast back on.
Think Field Yates can ball?
Probably. So George and Eric can be one team?
They'll be one of the best teams.
Right. Renner and Austin could be a sneaky good team. See, Renner could shoot.
Renner's really incredible. Well. Renner could absolutely carry them.
Right.
And Austin, we're going to set up this tournament where we're just like middle of the pack.
So anyway, the point is we think there's a realistic chance that we can pull this together at the combine.
Chris Sims, he could find a partner.
Florio? Because he Florio just had, and Sims?
Yes, I think him and Florio need to be together.
That would be amazing.
So, yeah, let us know any other NFL podcast pairings. We could get Bucky and let Daniel us know. Jeremiah.
Yeah, and we need to get a hashtag going so we can start to coordinate this. Let's get them all.
I'll send a note out to Will and see if we could pull this together. And maybe, you know, we promote it. And this would be good, some good
And then
stuff.
Obviously we need to rig the draw so that we can at least make it past a round.
I figure if we face Jess and Charlotte in the first round.
No, see, I think that's our worst opponent because you will be one of these people that like tiptoes around the women and won't touch them.
I do play down to my
competition. This is what I'm saying, right? You will like, oh, no, I can't guard a woman. And then she'll like just rack up points. No, we can't play that.
No, I'll swat them and have no.
You won't.
No issues doing
it. You'll let them. You'll open up the way to the basket.
If you put
you
a trophy
them.
At the end of this.
Anyway, so that's something we're going to be working on.
There's a lot going on. What a week in Miami.
It's escalated from us versus the Tomahawk show to all a giant tournament.
Super Bowl week is all about planting seeds. A lot of stuff going on.
Anyway, so the Super Bowl happened.
I went to. I want to make this like Regis and Kathy Lee, where they just talk about like all the parties they went to.
Sweet.
Can't, you know, the folks can't relate.
Uh-huh.
Went to the NFLPA party.
Yeah, you did.
The other night.
I didn't.
Sorry.
Yeah.
It's, you know, red carpet, high class event.
Huh.
But it is interesting when you run into players who know you.
Yeah.
And you're grading.
Yeah.
And they don't grade that well.
Ew.
And you have interesting conversations.
Yeah. How'd that go?
It was fine. It's all cordial. It's all good stuff. I just wanted to be all like, oh, look at me. I went to a party.
Yeah. Yeah,
it was good story. More seeds planted, though.
Huh.
Good stuff down the road. Anyway, let's get to the Super Bowl.
Yes.
Was it 54?
Live.
It was a good game.
It was. It was a really good game.
And this was all week. You picked the Chiefs, right?
Yeah.
I picked the Chiefs because we just figured Mahomes was too much and the passing offense is too much. But this kind of summed it up. Like, Mahomes was really bad for a better part of three quarters, but they accidentally scored 31 points.
Accidentally.
Right? I mean, they just stumble into points. And I think this is where it's the combination of Mahomes in this offense. You know, of course, we're going to get that big third and long pass to Tyreek and stuff like that. But the combination of being able to make special plays as Patrick Mahomes and scheme open plays and piece that all together, that's what makes this Chiefs offense so difficult to defend. And even with this great 49ers defense, they couldn't stop them in the end.
Yeah, it was interesting because the 49ers defense, I think, did a really good job in messing up the Chiefs offense. And this offense is so talented and so dangerous that even when they're struggling, like, it doesn't take long. It's like the Tyreek Hill thing, right? It's, you know, even if you have a Jalen Ramsey that you can put on him one-on-one all game long, it just takes one play.
Yeah.
One play, you switch off, and bam, you're beaten for a big play, and that's the game. And this is kind of what happened. The 49ers defense did a really good job on the Chiefs for most of the game, got him into a really crappy situation, and then perfect play call, perfect Mahomes, perfect Tyreek Hill, big play, now with a comeback is starting. But then the other thing to come out of it was the Chiefs defense, like, I don't think it's going to get almost any press whatsoever this morning, but the Chiefs defense did what it was we said they needed to do this year and was different from last year, that they're capable of getting a stop, right? They didn't need to stop them all game long, but they were capable of getting key stops at the right time. And that's all you need when the offense is as good as it was. So the Chiefs did execute a comeback, and then critically, their defense got some stops and stopped the 49ers rolling, and they were able to pull away at the end.
So many different storylines in this one. I think, again, we talked so much about this game over the last 2 weeks. I don't know when and where, what was on air, what was not. But I do remember saying at one point on some radio or some show, we're going to be looking back at coaching decisions because Andy Reid has this history of, you know, everybody, LOL, clock management, Andy Reid, ha ha ha, terrible. And Kyle Shanahan's got this 28-3 hanging over his head. He was the OC, and now he's got this 10-point lead with just over 7 minutes left hanging over his head.
Did you see the stat that he's now presided over the two largest win probability collapses in Super Bowl history?
Really?
The Patriots Falcons
one. Dan Quinn's got to be right there too.
The Patriots Falcons one, 99.7%.
Yeah.
That's just ridiculous.
Yesterday was only 95, according to ESPN.
Or something. Yeah.
Our probabilities would be a little different. I don't know what the exact numbers are, but a lot of people are talking about Shanahan. And I think because, you know, it's all about fourth quarter, right? What happened in the fourth quarter? And they're going to talk, he didn't run the ball enough. He didn't do this. He didn't do that. It was all the other stuff. It was all the other stuff. I think it was giving up the possession at the end of the first half. And I think it was kicking field goals on fourth and short versus Andy Reid, who went for it on fourth and short. Remember, he puts the kicking team out there on fourth and one in the first quarter, right? Pulls them back out. They go for it on fourth and one. They get it. They eventually score a touchdown. Getting sevens instead of threes adds up over time. And I think that is where Shanahan lost it, was giving up possessions and not getting a three at the end of the first half, because that's, you know, they should have been going for a field goal with all those timeouts and everything. That is the bigger issue, I think, than how they handled the last 10 minutes of the game.
Yeah. I mean, I don't even think Shanahan called that bad a game overall. I think the story is more the Andy Reid side of things. So they had the lowest fourth down go for it rate in the regular season, the yeah. Chiefs, of anybody. So as much as Andy Reid has been,
which is scary, right? If they just,
like, Eric Eager wrote a piece saying Andy Reid was the best coach in the NFL with a lot of evidence backing it up. Like, he was the best coach in the NFL despite shying away from one of those areas that the analytics loves. You know, one of the reasons Harbaugh was one of our coaches, was the coach of the year and our coach of the year as well, is because he went the other way, right? They had the most aggressive fourth down go for it rate. And these are the things that steal you extra possessions and win you games ultimately. Reid is arguably the best coach in the NFL despite being at the other end of that spectrum. But in the Super Bowl, when he's had, you know, this backstory of things not going his way, right from the get-go decided, no, screw it. If I'm going down, I'm going down the right way. Goes for it on fourth down twice, you know, in the first half. So I think that is the kind of thing that, look, they were in trouble. Like, this Chiefs team was not in a good spot early. It looked like things were going to go the other way. And they clung on because of those decisions that he made. Like, if he hadn't made those and instead had just gone for field goals, they would have been in a much worse spot.
Yeah. So overall, you'd say Andy outcoached Kyle. Now, Kyle, here's the other thing I think maybe he missed out on. Deebo Samuel was the best offensive weapon that they had for the majority of the game. They were using him in creative ways, the same way they had all season, 53 yards on three carries. And I'm not saying you don't feed your wide receiver on trick plays, right, as a strategy. But when you're in a 10-point game and you're leading and you want to run the clock out, that's where I think coaches get into this issue. They're like, do I run the ball? Do I pass the ball? Do you run basic plays and all this stuff? And maybe another Deebo run in there would have been nice. You know, some more of the trickeration that was working well early on, because the Niners run game wasn't that great. They had a couple 8-yard runs, 10-yard runs here and there. But other than that, it wasn't great.
It wasn't even good. I mean, Deebo was their offense for a big portion of this game.
The Chiefs were stacking the box and everything as we had expected. I thought Garoppolo was playing a very clean game, but it is one of those things where it's when he's protected, play action game, and, you know, he had a couple nice dig routes over the middle. The Kittle pass was probably the best pass of the entire game, the negated offensive pass interference.
I'm kind of surprised they called that. Like, I know why they did. You know, you can see extension, blah, 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 but
it just didn't slow down the defender. Like, it didn't slow down Sorensen, right?
Even though, I mean, it's the kind of call that they don't usually make in the Super Bowl, because the officials try to get away from being big parts of the game.
In particular, end of the half or end of the game.
Right. Like, people have done statistical studies and shown that they dial back the flags in the Super Bowl. And they do it in the playoffs, let alone the Super Bowl. But the Super Bowl, they really don't want to be a big part of the game. And, I mean, so the Kyle Rudolph push-off for the Vikings touchdown against New Orleans, right? That was as bad as that, and they didn't call that one. You can argue comfortably that was pass interference. I'm just surprised that they called it, given it was the Super Bowl.
Yeah, I agree. That's the whole thing with the officiating, right? You don't really know how it's going to play out.
Yeah,
that is the tough part about it.
I tweeted this yesterday and then thought we should probably start doing this. Chris Jones should essentially get an interception assist for that first pick. He absolutely wrecked the right guard was bearing down on Jimmy G, who just like heaved the ball down there and threw it right to, as a Bashaud Breeland.
Yeah.
Like there should be some sort of assist credited to Chris Jones for that.
That was, I mean, we could come up with that.
Did you see? That's what I'm saying. We should create that stat. Somebody freeze framed it. And like just before he's hit, Garoppolo legitimately has his eyes closed when he's throwing that ball. Maybe somebody just caught the right frame and, you know, he was had his eyes closed blinking. But there's a point where he's heaving that blindly downfield thinking, I'm sure George Kittle's out there somewhere, where he actually has his eyes closed heaving that ball to a cornerback.
Yeah, he avoided that first pressure and then tried to force it under pressure on the at the end of it. It wasn't good.
Yeah,
wasn't good. So there's just so much going on here. Mahomes looked rushed, hurried.
Yeah, he was hurried.
He was, but his process too, not like he's under everything about him was off. And this was the first time in his NFL career, I remember thinking, this is a lot of what we saw at Texas Tech. We saw, we posted on the website here. Here's our scouting report of Patrick Mahomes back in the day. Here are his strengths. Here are his weaknesses. Read his weaknesses now. They're not weak.
Right.
He turned his weaknesses into strengths. His ability to not necessarily play from the pocket and leaving a clean pocket and all these different things. And then he turns those into strengths. Then in this game, though, you know, forces a ball to Fred Warner, completely misreads the linebacker underneath. He has not been doing that during his NFL career. Two fumbles, one on the scramble that pops out of bounds, luckily, and then the one in the pocket that he recovers, a little bit of luck there.
Chiefs fumbled the ball three times, didn't lose any of them.
Lost, and they got all three of them. That seems to happen in Super Bowls. When you look back, you're like, hey, this team that recovered these fumbles, that's a good thing. You know, that's good for them. So then there was the throwaway to nobody that he threw right to Quan Alexander.
Mm.
Like it was hero ball. It was a little, it wasn't even hero ball. It was just like rattled.
I think this is a good example of how you can screw with a quarterback by pressure, right? And the point is not just the pressure itself that screws with him, but if you get a sufficient volume of it, even the plays where he's not under pressure, he's not right.
You can't,
like just changing the volume of the changing the balance of the volumes of those plays changes the overall outcome as well. So it's not just the pressure on plays with pressure forces bad plays like the Chris Jones thing, right? You get pressure, it's the quarterback still gets the pass away, but he throws an interception that he wouldn't have thrown otherwise. It's not just those plays. It's that if you get enough of them, now the quarterback's expecting pressure. He's playing in a different way. And even when he's clean, he's not making the throws he normally makes. And that was Mahomes yesterday. Even when they weren't getting after him, he felt it. Like he was different. He didn't have all day the way he normally does. He knew he didn't have all day. And he was just playing in a more skittish manner. You know, looked more like Baker Mayfield this year than he did Patrick Mahomes. And it's because they were able to get after him. And I really didn't think that the Chiefs were going to be able to come back from this, because the previous two times they'd been down by double digits, they were comfortable. Like they were in their element. Like things had gotten away from them, but it wasn't really because the offense had been struggling. It was because just weird plays broke the other way.
And the Niners were more equipped to slow them down, right?
Right.
Than the Titans.
And so
or the Chiefs
down before were in their, they were like in their comfort zone.
Right.
Now we get to go, you know, all out passing offense, no huddle. This is what we want to do anyway. And they just destroyed those teams.
Yeah.
But the 49ers in that situation, they had like legit pass rush. They got four guys that can get after you. Three of the four are winning their matchup. Like Mitchell Schwartz is the only guy in that offensive line that was holding up. And Schwartz, by the way,
yeah, give your little spiel on him because he's been awesome.
Well, he's had one of the best postseasons ever recorded by any player at any position. Like nobody will notice because he was a right tackle, and the best way, like your performance manifests itself by nobody noticing you. Essentially,
what an incredible run. I'm looking at it right now.
Right, but he played essentially 140 pass blocking snaps across those three games. Right, almost all of which they were trailing, and therefore in disadvantageous pass blocking situations, right? I.e. we're passing the ball. They know we're passing the ball. They're coming after me. Some of that featured playing guys like JJ Watt for like 50 snaps, right? So he's pass blocking against legit pass rushers, JJ Watt, D Ford, the Titans, in a crappy situation, knowing that he has to, that they have to pass the ball, and gave up two hurries. That's it.
That's
just
incredible.
Two hurries. It's absurd. So Mitchell Schwartz locks down D Ford yesterday, completely dominated him, but all the other guys were struggling against their assignments, in particular Eric Fisher, who got wrecked by Nick Bosa.
Yeah.
Nick Bosa may well have been the best player in the game, and if the 49ers had won, I think should have been the MVP. Whether he would have or not is another matter. But he had like double digit pressures in that game. Like, he was a beast. But anyway, the point is they were all getting after Mahomes.
Right.
And when you get that the other thing is they were coming after him in packs, right? It's like, it wasn't just one guy you had to avoid. It's one guy, crap, now there's two more. Uh-oh, throw. Like, he was just under duress, and it was amazing to come back from that.
So somebody asked me, too, is like, oh, does this game show that, you know, that whole like coverage over pass rush debate? I'm like, listen, one game, never. I know people like to take victory laps over one game. The whole point of having a theory, like, first off, there's no theory that's like 90% solid. Like, this is going to happen 90% of the time, right? Most theories are like giving you like a 5% edge or something like that. So if you have like a better coverage unit versus a pass rush unit, you're going to win an extra 5 games out of 100, 10 games, you know, whatever, you know, it's small. But so this isn't a victory lap on anything, but in this game, despite all that pressure, despite all of that, Mahomes made a bunch of big throws while getting hit as well.
Mm-hmm.
And he threw for 142 yards and went under pressure, and he threw for 144 from a clean pocket. So 2 yard difference. So he had his biggest completions, the Tyreek Hill play, Sammy Watkins up the sideline for 28. He had some of his biggest plays under pressure. So, you know, I think that kind of shows it too, as great as the 49ers defensive line is. And you're right. I mean, when you have four guys, it's not about pressure rate. It's not like, hey, we got there 30% of the time. It's like, here's one guy and here's two guys. Like, we have two guys winning at the same time, or there's one guy winning quick, and all of that stuff, you know, is a factor. As great as the 49ers D line is,
well, and
they didn't cover well on some huge plays in the back end.
Ultimately, I would say this actually goes the other way, right? Because their pass rush was really good in this game, and yet they got beat because they got beaten coverage, right? Sherman gave up a big one to Sammy Watkins. They collectively missed on the 3rd and 15 to Tyreek Hill. Like, they got pressure on those plays, and it didn't matter because the coverage didn't hold up. So, yeah, look, elite pass rush is always a good thing. If you can get it affected this game in a major way, and it gave their defense a real shot at pulling this off. But the coverage wasn't able to hold up in key moments, and therefore they didn't win.
Yeah, the whole point is if you have bad coverage, it doesn't matter.
Yes.
About the pass rush. So Sherman getting whooped by Sammy Watkins on a bomb, Tyreek Hill sneaking behind the defense, which our friend Peter King says was called WASP. From Andy Reid.
What was the play? Was WASP?
Yeah. Well, that's just like the tag or the whatever they call it. Yeah. It was some sort of like three verts where they just Tyreek Hill up.
This was the play that completely changed the game.
You right? Broke this down over at PFF.com.
Yeah. So 3rd and 15, right? The 49ers have been getting pressure. They're down by 10 right at this point.
Yep.
7 minutes left on the clock. It's like, if they don't, this was the play before that, was the pass to Tyreek Hill, where he underthrew it. It looked like he caught it. They challenged it. Turned out he trapped the ball against the ground. No play, right? So that turns that into 3rd and 15 from inside Kansas City's territory. If you don't get this play, you probably have to punt the ball back. Or if you don't punt it, you have to go for 4th and long in your own half to keep this thing alive. So you're in a real horrible situation right now. And the funny thing is, the play call actually took advantage of that, right? Because 3rd and 15, the 49ers aren't going to be aggressive. They're going to be playing the sticks, saying, all right, we're going to keep everything in front of us, play the first down marker and let you have the easy stuff, right? So the Chiefs essentially use that to attack the back end of the coverage. So we move Tyreek Hill into the slot. That gives him a free release up the middle of the field. You can't jam him. And we know that everybody else is going to reacting on anything that breaks in and around the first down marker.
Right.
So we can attack the free safety. He's got to deal with a two-way go against Tyreek Hill. That's just, that guy's got no shot, right? But you think there should be a cornerback over where he ends up. But there isn't, because Sammy Watkins ran a dig at the first down marker.
Right.
So the cornerback has to drive on that because it's 3rd and 15. There's no way I can anticipate something else coming in behind me. So he's sprinting in the exact opposite direction of where the pass is going to go. The safety's given more problems because Travis Kelce is running up the middle as well. So he's got to think about two different things. And it's just, it's a fantastic play call at that moment. They completely screwed that coverage. And the key is they got pressure on the play. Mahomes is
a little late.
Yeah. And Mahomes is able to just hang in there enough until it's open.
They bought enough time for sure. That, you know, I love the chalkboard call of like, let's play the sticks. But I feel like we saw that a lot early in the season by multiple teams where it's just like third and 10, just sit at the 10 yards deep, sit 15 yards deep on third and 15, whatever it is. But those are the routes because you're so, it puts into the defense's mind sticks. We're playing the sticks. We're playing the sticks. And if everybody's making a line across the sticks, you can sneak somebody behind them. And they had been playing robber coverage where that middle of the field defender sitting at 15, 20 yards. They got behind him. I mean, there was a lot of nuance to that play and everything. You're right. I mean, for all the pressure that Mahomes faced, there was just enough time on that play to get the throw off.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, third and 15 is a massively advantageous position for the defense. You don't often see an offense play call and play design that's specifically crafted to take advantage of that, to flip the advantage, right? To take it from a disadvantage and flip it into an advantage, which is as long as we can hold up just long enough to get this ball in the air, we can manipulate the defenders because we know they're going to drive on anything at the markers. So if we have enough time for all the routes to run to make a break towards 15 yards, we can kill them because they have to play everything else.
I thought another story in this game was just the red zone work by both teams. It was kind of cool. Both teams, and Kansas City was weird, not going to lie. Both teams felt like, because they're creative, right? Two of the most creative offensive minds, and Andy Reid's not necessarily creative in like drawing up new plays all the time, or Eric Bieniemy too. You got to give all these guys credit. Because he kind of runs his thing. He just adds a lot of window dressing to it. But the Chiefs came out running like pure option football. And it wasn't like they started the game with speed option, right? And then it just kept going from there. They ran like four or five option plays and they're running 1947. I think my video did better than yours too, by the way. Did you post a video of this too?
Of what?
Oh, the dance? The dance move. Did you do better than this?
I don't know.
What 1800 likes and. That was good.
As many followers as me,
those too, shifts,
you don't check what those videos do.
Because Kelly's like, you posted it and Gordon posted it and Sam posted it. I think yours is doing best. She was watching. Huh. Anyway, the 1947 single wing concepts and all this stuff. And it was almost like, here's our red zone package. It's going to be option heavy. And they did a whole bunch of different option variations with Mahomes as a design runner, which, by the way, that's also scary for the future that you could just, you know, pull that out whenever you want. And then the Niners did a really nice job getting Juszczyk in space, you know, they ran the boot action. He's like leaking to the flat. That's why he had the touchdown and then almost a second touchdown on the same exact play that they flipped. So I thought the red zone offenses on both sides were pretty creative and overall did a nice job. Though, again, the Niners left some plays on the table by kicking field goals.
So all those early plays with the option stuff, you know what that is?
What?
It's rugby. Oh, I thought about this as it was happening. I was like, I'm going to really upset Steve the next day.
Do you realize our hour-by-hour ratings, our minute-by-minute ratings go how far they tank once you bring up rugby?
The touchdown in particular was perfectly executing a two-on-one, right? The idea
you have 15 seconds.
The idea with rugby is you have to generate space and essentially create an overlap. And that's what this option stuff is. And it doesn't always have to go to the guy outside because if he overplays it, you can keep the ball and do what Mahomes did.
Rugby principles.
But the really interesting thing is everybody's been talking about bringing rugby guys in for tackling, right? The Seahawks brought rugby guys in. The 49ers have used rugby guys for tackling.
Your time's up.
That's the benefit to rugby. But actually, this is where it's going. Like teaching space principles to use in option football from rugby is what teams should be doing. Bringing in guys to consult on this stuff and explaining how to manufacture these.
I'll do that when I'm running a team.
Yeah. I can help you out there.
The other thing when I'm running a team that I'll do, and I mentioned this many podcasts ago, Zach Robinson, the assistant quarterback coach for the Rams, is going to be on my defensive coaching staff.
Huh.
He's going to be on the defense. He is as good as it gets at knowing how to screw up quarterbacks. He's a quarterback coach who's really good at knowing quarterback weaknesses.
That doesn't come off very well.
Screw up quarterbacks?
Yeah.
Why? to mess with him.
He's a quarterback coach, and you just said he's amazing at screwing up quarterbacks.
Oh, I understand what you're
right.
saying now.
See where I'm going
and
with that?
Jared Goff did kind of regress this year.
What you've essentially just said is that he is horrendous at his job, and therefore I'm going to put him on defense.
What I meant is he's so good at defensive game plan type of stuff. Right. We're going to put him.
The Houston job's gone.
Yeah, Bill O'Brien promotes himself, apparently.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's another one you didn't get.
I didn't want it anyway. They don't have a first round pick till like 2030.
Well, that's the genius of the situation.
Brady's going to be a granddad the next time the Texans draft in the first round.
Bill O'Brien made the job so undesirable that only he wanted it. Genius.
It is genius.
Can't fall to strategy.
If I trade my next four first rounders for a left tackle, we're good.
Yeah.
Nobody will want this job.
We need to be careful what we say about him because he's coming in the building soon, right?
So, yeah, he's going to come hang out. So red zone stuff was cool. There's a lot of interesting things there. For as rattled as Mahomes looked, ice water in his veins down the stretch. I mean, he was fantastic. I saw somebody comparing Andy Reid being down 10 to when he was down 10 with the Eagles against the Patriots.
Yeah.
Back in the 2004 Super Bowl, I actually likened it more to the Patriots are down 10 back against Seattle a few years ago, down 10, 8 minutes left, just like yesterday, going up against a Richard Sherman led top defense in the league. And both times, the better offense came through with the good offense came through with Patriots, made the comeback against the Seahawks with two touchdowns. And the Chiefs actually went with three touchdowns because of that late run from Damien Williams.
Chiefs have the record for the most fourth quarter points in a Super Bowl now.
Oh, how about that?
21.
Don't you love being on that email?
I really don't.
Halftime
I've been trying to work out ways of getting off.
I liked the halftime game book update.
Is there like an unsubscribe list?
NFL.com communication sending us updates and stats and records. We should just read the records that were set.
There's no unsubscribe button. Am I just like on this thing for life now?
You know what is funny? There was like four records set in the game yesterday. After like a New England Super Bowl, there's probably like 100. Like Brady breaks every record.
Yeah,
every year.
Hang on for like a million years.
Every year.
What did you think of his Super Bowl commercial?
I thought they did a good job of promoting that stuff. We have to analyze it, right? Is Brady's back in New England?
He's not going anywhere. That's what the ad says.
He's not going anywhere. And so I think what we should do is say, what would that perfect offseason look like for the Patriots building weapons around him? How would they actually do that? Because apparently that's the rumor, is that he's willing to make $30 million. They're willing to pay him $30 million for whatever that's worth, and he just wants them to spend on playmakers.
This doesn't make sense, right? If you've been taking a hometown discount for like a decade and they need to spend money on getting you playmakers, why would you suddenly want the $30 million? Like, you're just hurting yourself.
You didn't hear the report.
What report?
The report said the Patriots are willing to pay $30 million a year. It says nothing about Brady's demands or how much he wants or anything.
Right, but why would they? Like, that's the whole thing is just ridiculous. There's no reason they should be.
Because they already have like $12 million dead for him.
Yeah, but like the whole point is every dollar you give to Brady is a dollar you can't give to somebody that Brady needs to help him.
Right.
He knows that. They know that. So why would $30 million be the figure? Should be 25, 20.
But you're whatever. Making it seem like Brady's demanding that or whatever.
Well, they're not offering it for fun. Like, they're not doing it out of the goodness of their hearts. They're doing it because they think that's what it takes to get him back.
Did you see the confetti was all tweets?
What?
The confetti was red and yellow confetti. And then the white was tweets, relevant tweets about, say, the Chiefs.
Are you on there?
I'm not. I don't know if there is one. So this one's like, I thank the football gods every day for giving us Patrick Mahomes. Some of them are like, it's just like Chiefs related tweets or Patrick Mahomes related tweets. That's what fell with the confetti.
That seems like a lot of effort.
And they're all over the field. Your friend Jess was like, I need to find one with my name on it. And she, I don't know if she did ever, but yeah. I've seen people tweeting out some of these tweets.
That does seem like a lot of effort to go to.
It's creative. Somebody had to cut up all these tweets and put it in the confetti. That must've been weeks of work.
Ass.
A lot of research. What's your job description there? I'm like the
I don't know
tweet collector for the confetti for the next
intern,
6 months.
I would think
intern, perhaps. Yeah. Great.
So, what else do we have to say about the Super Bowl?
So everybody's got to talk long term and legacy and Mahomes and is he the face of the NFL? Man, we just love creating massive stories. So, how many more times is Mahomes? In the Chiefs, how many more times are they coming back? How many more Super Bowls are they going to win?
So the first thing I think is this is good. I'm happy that Andy Reid won, right? Because as much as it shouldn't, this affects his legacy.
It does.
Like, he is one of the greatest coaches.
I think it matters, though.
He's one of the greatest coaches of the last couple of decades and one of the best ever.
Why shouldn't it affect his legacy?
Because of course it should. He's still one of the greatest coaches, whether a play breaks the other way or not.
He's better now because they won a Super Bowl. That does mean something.
No, he's not. He's the same guy. He just won a Super Bowl.
Okay, he's the same guy, but his accomplishments are different. Like, you get weighed by your accomplishments.
So
is this an accomplishment?
Yeah.
So then things have changed.
Things haven't changed. He's the same coach. He's the same level of coach. He just has a ring that validates him in the eyes of many now.
Yeah, I'm not saying it's like, is this the difference
it's
between
like
Hall
Marino,
of Famer?
Right? Dan Marino is still an all-time great quarterback, whether he won a ring or not. He didn't win a ring. Unlucky. It would have been nicer if he'd won a ring.
He would have had more accomplishments if he carried his team to a ring.
Either
like
way, he's an all-time great. Same with Andy Reid. He is an all-time great, regardless of what happened
last
night. Yeah,
but if you're looking at it from a binary, are you an all-time great or not?
Right.
Okay,
right.
So if you're just one or zero, then one, yes, you're an all-time great.
Okay.
If you want to add to that and increase your accomplishments, Andy Reid did that.
In the eyes of many, he needed a ring in order to go down as any kind of all-time great coach. That is silly. But now he has that ring, so we can get rid of that. That's not a thing anymore. Andy Reid is officially an all-time great coach because he has a ring. So for him, it's good that he got that. It's nice. I think we can finally stop talking about him in this sort of asterisk terms. The flip side of that is poor old Kyle Shanahan now has two of these hanging over him,
mm-hmm.
and he becomes the new Andy Reid, albeit significantly younger and with time on his side. The Reid and Mahomes thing is interesting because, like, they're the dominant force in certainly in the AFC and the NFL right now. But Reid's kind of old, and he just like got the monkey off his back in terms of, you know, this is the thing to validate him. Like, how long does he hang around for?
So here's the interesting thing about NFL history, right? I mean, I feel like we're just coming off the Patriots run, or maybe they're still here. Who knows? But the Patriots run of 20 years in dynasty or dynasty or whatever you want to call it. And it's like, oh, this is so rare. But the NFL has been consistent dynasties, right? Like 3 and 4 year you know, Super Bowl runs per decade, right? You get the Steelers in the 70s, you get the Niners in the 80s, the Cowboys in the 90s, the Patriots for the last 20 years. So it's like pretty common in the NFL that teams string together 2, 3, 4 Super Bowls. Like it happens, right? Once every decade or two.
Sort of.
So the Chiefs are positioned to be that team, potentially.
I don't think you can look at it that way because free agency changed everything. Right.
Did it? The Patriots just
that's the thing.
Thwarted right? it.
So the whole point is if you take away the Patriots, I don't think the same thing happens. So the league was set up in a way that dynasties were a thing. Steelers, Cowboys, 49ers, blah, blah, blah. Then free agency came along, which disrupts everything and should torpedo that idea. Now, the Patriots have a quarterback that's played until he's 127 years old and the greatest NFL coach that's ever been.
Wait, it's the greatest quarterback of all time.
So you pair those two things together and they're able to buck the idea of free agency dismantling teams for like two decades. So the Patriots essentially broke the NFL for the entire duration of this combination. If that's disappearing now, I don't think they're going to make way for another dynasty because that's the way the NFL works. I think they have broken the NFL for the better part of 20 years. And now we're going to see what the landscape actually looks like when all things are equal.
No, I do think we are in more of a parity driven NFL. I mean, it's pretty easy to forget that the Ravens were just 14-2 and they have the MVP in Lamar Jackson. I think the AFC is going to be much more competitive because Belichick and the Patriots are still around. The Ravens are here. Deshaun Watson and the Texans. And there's a whole slew of young quarterbacks. Baker Mayfield could turn it around in a year. Joe Burrow might be joining the mix next year. Derek Carr and the Raiders. I mean, there's just, you know, good teams and players. And I think the NFC, I think the most difficult part about the Niners' loss is the NFC has showed us like it's a new team every year. Mm-hmm. And I think that has really summed up. I think the AFC might be moving toward what the NFC has been. It was the Niners this year and the Rams the previous year, Eagles before that, Falcons before that, Panthers before that. Seahawks for 2 years before that. I mean, it has been a different team.
I think that's kind of what I'm saying, right? Is that shows that if you just take the Patriots out of the equation, that's what the league looks like. It's another team comes along every year. It's not, I don't think you're going to get a dynasty materialized to replace the Patriots. I think they've just been anomalies for 20 years.
Here's the point I wanted to make on this, right? All of the dynasties have had a quarterback and head coach combination that have been consistent, right? So like Montana was attached. What are you smiling at?
Somebody's posting bet tickets of the loss that came because the Mahomes run. Of Mahomes kneel downs.
That's awesome.
Kneel downs at the end cost people big betting money.
That's unfortunate.
That is unfortunate.
That's what you get.
Particularly because one of them was minus 7 yards.
Right. And they needed to do it. They needed to run just enough time off the clock.
So
his
kneel downs cost them 15 yards.
Yeah.
And that cost people money, including this guy apparently cost him $2,100.
Oh, that's too bad.
Yeah.
Imagine that.
That would suck.
That's
that would
a bad
suck
beat.
A lot.
So anyway, it's been, Montana was paired with Bill Walsh and then Seifert for a year. Is that right? Yeah. Seifert for a year. Cowboys had Aikman and Jimmy Johnson. They did have Barry Switzer for a year. Patriots, of course, had Brady Belichick. So by all accounts, I mean, Mahomes is great enough to kind of carry the torch beyond Andy Reid if he only lasts another year or two. Maybe Eric Bieniemy ends up taking over and you've got the offensive system in place or whatever it might be. But that'll be something else interesting to take a look at, because it's usually a quarterback and a head coach attached with maybe like 1 year of, change on the back end of it. I just want to go back and rehash the Chiefs history here really quick.
Okay.
Just the 2017, and this is Andy Reid. This is one of the reasons, not the whole history.
Not like the franchise history.
This is one of the reasons why Eric wrote this article
way
about
back
Andy Reid.
When they were the Dallas Texans.
Let's go back 50 years ago and Lamar Hunt and
Clark Hunt.
Clark, sorry.
Which one?
Lamar.
No, Lamar.
It's a Lamar Hunt trophy. Come on, don't confuse me.
Lamar Hunt when they were the Dallas Texans.
What if they loved the Lamar Hunt trophy so much? They're like, forget the Lombardi. We just want this AFC championship.
Mm.
No. Anyway, so go back to 2017. The Chiefs went hashtag good to great. They just said, we have Alex Smith. We're a 10 win team annually. Alex Smith gets us on the green. We're going to be in the playoffs. Anything can happen in the playoffs. But Andy Reid in the front office, they said, we got to go get Patrick Mahomes. We're pretty good with Alex Smith. You can scheme it up. We do all this stuff to extract really good passing production out of Alex Smith. They said, we got to go for it with Patrick Mahomes. We're sitting here on the podcast in 2017 saying, I think they're going to pull Mahomes in halfway through the season or the end of the season, go on a playoff run, try to win it. And who knows, maybe they could have, as well as Alex Smith played that year, even though he led the league in passer rating and was really efficient. But so much credit to them for taking a good team, taking a chance on Patrick Mahomes, pushing Alex Smith out the door, trading him. And then since that time, Mahomes is MVP and then Super Bowl MVP the next year. That is why we're here today. Andy Reid, who has a history of elevating quarterbacks and making them good, they made a power move to go get the most talented quarterback he's ever had and have turned him into what people are calling the face of the NFL.
Yeah.
That's why we're here today. So credit them.
Okay.
Elite quarterbacks give you a very good
credit too, Andy Reid.
Chance. I'm writing a little piece this week about outlier quarterback seasons. It's really fascinating because Brady, Breeze, Rodgers, and Peyton account for 60% of our top 20 quarterback grades. So those four account for 60% of our top 20 seasons during the last decade. And they account for 50% of our top 50 graded seasons. Just those four guys. If you add the next tier of quarterbacks to that, Andrew Luck, Big Ben, Matt Ryan, Phillip Rivers, Russell Wilson, and say Mahomes, those guys make up about 85% of our top 50 graded quarterback seasons. There's like a couple outliers here and there. I'm going to write up what those outliers are.
Okay.
Cam Newton, Carson Palmer, Eli. RG3. It should be interesting. But the point is the elite quarterback simply gives you a much better opportunity to win. And there's really tough to find. And they make up the majority of the greatness in the NFL right now. So it is kind of skewed towards those guys. And everything else is pretty much an outlier until you get to that point.
Should we move on to awards?
Yeah. What do you want to discuss? Lamar Jackson gets the MVP.
Yes.
I think that was well deserved, and I think they were fine and got it right.
This is the most interesting one because PFF obviously picked Russell Wilson as MVP.
Correct.
And what's this guy's name? Chase something? You know what Stewart. His second name is? Chase Stewart from, what's his name? Football Perspective, FBG Chase on Twitter.
Yep.
Had a tweet that was all 50 AP voters picked Lamar Jackson as MVP. All 9 Sports Illustrated voters picked Jackson. The PFWA picked Jackson. The Sporting News picked Jackson. PFF picked Russell Wilson as MVP. To which my reply was simply, well, there's one entity on that list that's done work to actually quantify value in this, and it's none of the newspapers. Now, the point is, so as you know, Steve, I think MVP is a stupid award.
Okay.
And should be abolished.
Can we just, and I want to start this whole thing by saying, I don't think anybody's like angry about Lamar getting the award.
No,
I think perfectly fine.
Lamar had a good case. I think Russell Wilson had a good case. I think the differences between the two are gray enough that it's not clear cut either way. And I think anybody saying it is working with less information than they need to be.
Yeah.
Now my point is simply, so MVP is stupid, right? In most sports, what you're trying to do is recognize the most outstanding season of the year, right? That's the general idea behind MVP. In most sports, those are the same, the most valuable and the best. It's the same thing. In the NFL, we've created this game where quarterback is by far and away the most important position to almost the exclusion of anything else. As you just said, you know, an elite quarterback gives you a shot at the big dance every single year, regardless of anything else around him.
Yep.
Quarterback is everything. So the MVP is a quarterback every single season, or in theory. But anyway, in football, we spend our time tying ourselves in knots, trying to parse out this idea of value. And it's silly because nobody ever gets anywhere. It's just like, well, what's more valuable? This guy has a terrible backup, so he's more valuable because if they lose him, they're screwed.
Using the backup is the worst excuse ever.
All of them are terrible. Like, everybody comes up with a theory of what is value, and it's all dumb. It's ridiculous. It's subjective idiocy that makes no sense in any realm, but that's the reason that people use to back up value of MVP, right? So we actually stopped giving this award for years because it was so ridiculous. We created the Dwight Stevenson Award, which is the best player, period, regardless of position. We brought it back because smart math people came on board, Eric and George, and those guys started to do serious legwork in quantifying what value is from a winning perspective. So not, you know, contract, not actually what players play is quantifiably impacting their team's chances of winning games,
right?
Which ultimately is the whole point in all of this, right? So they devised this PFF war metric. Now, they're not the only people that have done work in that area, but I'm pretty sure that
you got called out on too.
Well, only because people can't read tweets, right? It's 280 characters. Is reading all of them really asking too much? That's my point. To which apparently the answer is yes. Anyway, so we're not the only people that's done work in this area, but I'm pretty sure we're the only people that give out awards that have, which is a key differentiator here. Because while everybody else picked Lamar Jackson, we have actually looked into which guy's play has the most impact on their team winning and losing games. And by that, it's Russell Wilson. Now,
I also imagine it's very difficult to parse that out if you don't have play-by-play grading. If you don't truly have something that evaluates the right guard or right tackle on a given play, it is tough to give proper credit.
It is.
On a play or in a game or for the season.
It's also a big problem because a lot of people have no interest in separating out an individual's performance from the unit that they are attached to. Right? So think of offensive linemen, right? For years, offensive linemen, we don't have any information. So who has the best offense? Who gets sacked the least? Who has the most rushing yards? Their offensive lineman's probably great.
And here's an example. I was just researching something on Pro Football Reference, a site that's got a lot of good stats on there. And in 2013, Peyton Manning's record-breaking season, their approximate value figure, which essentially says if you're on the field while good things are happening, we'll compare you to other guys at the same position where stuff happens and see. So the highest approximate value that in 2013 Peyton Manning season was Louis Vasquez. He had a 20 in this number. Peyton Manning was a 19. So Peyton was clearly the influence of all these numbers, but Louis Vasquez was the right guard during this stuff and got all the value. So it's very difficult to do.
I mean, there are terrible offensive linemen that have gone to the Pro Bowl based off the fact that they have an elite quarterback like Peyton
Manning. They're in a good offense.
Who protected them. So this is part of the problem, right? Lamar Jackson was spectacular this year, right? But clearly there is an impact, an influence that the system had on him, right? This idea of we create a custom offense 100% tailored to your skill set, which will make your life easier, right? That has an impact. Now, the flip side of that is Russell Wilson was in an offense where almost the opposite was happening. It was like, you're amazing. We are going to make your life as hard as humanly possible by running the ball in second and long and basically hoping you bail us out when it goes badly.
I would argue two different. Are you done with your point there?
No. Similarly, John Harbaugh won Coach of the Year. Greg Roman won Assistant Coach of the Year. Those two guys were doing things that helped out Jackson. The fact that Harbaugh went for a fourth down more than anybody else, which extended drives, which made Jackson's stats look better. The two-point stuff, they were putting them in beneficial situations. Again, the flip side is the Seahawks are doing the opposite.
There's a flip side to the decision.
Flip side to the flip side?
Yes. Lamar Jackson is the talent that they built so that custom system around.
That's where it gets complicated, right? Now, you have to acknowledge that the impact of other people around them, right? Again, the Ravens have one of the best offensive lines in the NFL. The Seahawks have one of the worst. Those things impact the production. Now, where it gets really complicated is, you're right, Lamar Jackson has a unique skill set, which is the reason they were able to build a custom offense around him that, in turn, makes his life easier. I don't know that there's any way of quantifying where the value in all of that lies, right? I don't know that anyway. A, I don't know that we can do it now. B, I don't know that you can ever do that. Like, where is the chicken and the egg in this scenario? Who deserves the value element of it? But to not even acknowledge that it exists, and it's a thing, to just go, he threw for a bunch of yards and touchdowns, ran for a bunch of yards and touchdowns more than this guy, therefore he was more valuable. That's just stupid. Like, that's genuinely dumb.
We're really
not going far enough.
We're trying to get to the nuance of this thing.
Right.
And which is a challenge, admittedly is a challenge, but we're trying to.
Yes. Now, the other thing is, so look, these are all venerable institutions that have been doing this for a long time. There's a lot of smart people working for them. On the other hand, there is also a guy who voted for somebody at the wrong position. So there's only so much I'm willing to go with their take as gospel.
Right.
Right. Now, PFF isn't gospel either, but we're at least going far enough to be able to determine who was playing in a certain position. Right. Whether you think we're getting to the right answer or not, we're at least starting from a position of knowing who played and where they played.
Yeah, I get that.
So I just think, look, I think both guys had fantastic seasons. I think there is a strong case that either one of them was the most valuable player in the NFL. They went with Lamar Jackson. I don't necessarily think that's wrong, but I think in looking at it and saying he was unanimous, therefore you're morons, is just missing the point. Everybody that voted for him and picked him as unanimous is working from less information and is not looking deep enough.
Yeah. So let me add to that, right? So part of our war metric is saying, here's this player's contribution to the wins and here's the rest of his teammates. So it does truly take in the rest of your teammates. Now, if there is that crossover from Lamar, where he's making the O-line better, or he's making the receivers better, or he's making Mark Ingram and the running backs better, then there's some overlap there, right? And trying to say, okay, because Lamar is so difficult to defend, poor defensive linemen trying to figure out where the ball is, and they're getting blown off the ball, therefore the O-line looks good.
And that's all definitely true.
Right, and there's only so much we can roll that into the math, right?
And the question is then quantifying it, right? But my problem with it all is I don't think anyone's even asking the question.
So I would here are the two things that I think people miss on when they're doing this whole MVP race thing, right? And it was like all my joke tweets about, here's Russell Wilson on Monday Night Football. His MVP stock's either going here or here, because it's what everybody sees. I think people see an MVP race the entire year as like this, right? Here's Wilson at one point during the season. Here's Lamar Jackson. And if Wilson has a bad game and Lamar has a good game, it goes like this, right? Where we're saying we're quantifying every single throw. So at one point during the season, The MVP race was probably Wilson here and Lamar here by our numbers, right? And then when Lamar had a great game, he went here. And Wilson didn't have a great game. Like, so Lamar was, and this is for our podcast listeners, right. I put a lot almost of space in between our hand, my hands. So Wilson was so far ahead at one point, Lamar could have strung five games together. And in our numbers, which are just play-by-play driven, may not have caught up. What happens in the race is you see it as like a race that's neck and neck the entire time, right? And it's like, okay, in week 12, Lamar wins. Week 13, Lamar wins. 14, Lamar. Okay, Lamar's the MVP. I mean, he's just stringing it together at the right time here. Here's the other part. When we are isolating value, we're literally doing it differently from everybody else, because I saw the thread that you were in, and all I saw was a picture of stats sent back to you.
Yeah.
Here are the stats. First down percentage. Even the advanced stat, adjusted net yards per attempt, adjusted yards per attempt, yards per attempt, passer rate, whatever numbers you want to use. Literally every single one of those numbers is dependent on somebody around you to a point. If you make a great throw and it's dropped, it does not enhance any of those numbers. Wilson had a game against the Eagles where he had four big time throws. I think three of them were dropped. Two of them should have been touchdowns. He also had a wide open touchdown that he missed as well. Whatever. All I'm saying is that game, that was the week where like the whole script flipped on Russell Wilson.
Yeah.
Week 12, 11, whatever it was.
Right. It was
he had three big time throws that should have been a touchdown, which completely would have changed the stats. And the whole narrative changed because it was like Wilson had a bad game.
Right. The narrative is Wilson tailed off towards the second half of the season. I mean, he really didn't. It's just that other people started to let him down more than they had in the first half of the season.
Right.
My whole point is.
And hold on. But that actually enhances his case.
Yeah.
For us. So in our work. So as Lamar is making great plays. And by the way, Lamar played awesome this year. Lamar was incredible. When Lamar's making great plays and his teammates are also making great plays, both of their values are going up. When Wilson's making great plays and they're not being caught, the other team players on his team value is going down. So when Wilson makes great plays that don't become touchdowns because of his teammates, his value is actually increasing wider than Lamar making great plays that become touchdowns. Does that all make sense?
Yes.
Because we are actually isolating every single player. So that's why at the end of the year, when it's Russell Wilson as a part of his entire team, was more valuable to that entity of players than Lamar was. And Lamar had more success because the whole body of work in that team and the play calling, all that stuff was better.
I think football is one of the hardest games in the world to isolate the performance of an individual from the environment around him, right? It's really, really hard because everything affects everything else. It's so difficult to try and distill one thing from everything else. But if you're going to start talking about, you know, player performance and value and who was the most valuable player in the NFL, you have to do that, right? That's what, like, it, by definition, that's what that's requiring you to do, is to dive into this and try and extricate one player from everything else around him. And if you're not even trying to do that, then you suck. That's basically what I'm saying.
Well,
you're not even attempting to pull out one player from everything else around him, how can you possibly accurately determine whether he was the most valuable? What you're just saying is he was the best player on a unit that was awesome, and that's really as far as I'm prepared to dive right here.
Look, the quarterback dictates production more than anyone else.
Yes.
Right? So Lamar deserves a ton of credit for all of the production created in Baltimore.
We also made him our offensive player of the year, by the way.
Of course.
It's not like we hate him.
He was absolutely special this year. Exceeded even our highest expectations.
And we broke our methodology to do that. Like, we shoehorned him into that award because he was that good.
He was good. And in acknowledging that, you know, the other parts of the team were probably aided by him. That blurry picture again.
It really is blurry now that you've pointed it out.
Like Clyde Burke over here.
Clyde Burke?
He's in the YouTube chat saying sometimes these guys focus too much on numbers instead of the eye test. We are literally using the eye test when I'm pulling out Russell Wilson throwing a dime, a back shoulder dime where David Moore just like doesn't put his hands together. This should have been a touchdown. Or a deep ball that DK Metcalf drops or whatever. I'm using my eye test to say that pass was awesome. Where people are wrong is when they get to the end of the game and Lamar threw five touchdowns and one of them was a screen and one of them was a swing pass to Mark Ingram. You're not using your eye test. The eye test on that is like, that was an easy pass. The emotional test is that's a touchdown. That's great. It's we're actually separating the eye test, which we're better at. We're quantifying the eye test than the emotional test, which everybody says touchdowns, interceptions, stats, yards per attempt.
You know, the other thing about the eye test is your eyes suck. Your eyes lie a lot of the time, right? You ever see those optical illusions? Here are these two squares. It turns out they're the same color. What the hell? You know what I mean? Do I have a brain tumor? No, they are the same color. Your eyes suck.
How about the dress?
They
thing?
Can lie to you. Right.
The yellow dress that was blue.
Is this yellow or blue? Your eyes lie all the time, right? So just having a look at something, going, well, my eye test says this guy's amazing. Right. Maybe your eyes are lying to you. Maybe if you look a little bit deeper, you'll find out that actually there's more to this. So Lamar, the eye test is a thing that sounds great, but actually might not be.
Lamar was awesome. I think he deserved MVP. I think the idea that Russell Wilson wasn't in consideration, I think, is the point that's off.
Yes. And I think just saying that it was unanimous, therefore you're wrong, is also missing the point. You need to dive deeper into all of this and at least see that there's an argument for the other way.
Yeah.
It's not necessarily saying we're right, but it's saying that, look, we're looking at information that you're not even considering. At that point, you know, take a look and then come to a different conclusion or the same one, but take a look.
The only other... So there's two other awards, I think, off the top of my head I wanted to comment on.
Yes, do it. What do you got?
The two rookie awards.
Okay.
So I thought Offensive Rookie of the Year was off with Kyler Murray. He was the second best rookie quarterback behind Gardner Minshew.
He was a quarterback, Steve.
So he was a quarterback. Wins. But this isn't a value thing. Like, this doesn't have value in the name. And this is where we split hairs with you. If you have value in the name of the MVP award, it's like, oh, we got to focus on value. If you're just saying Offensive Rookie of the Year, technically, like, Quentin Nelson probably should have won it 2 years ago. But, you know, it should be it could be anybody.
This year, it's one of the receivers.
Offensive Rookie of the Year. I mean, A.J. Brown had a legendary season. Terry McLaurin was awesome. Mm-hmm. And Josh Jacobs was one of the best running backs in the league. It's one of those three guys.
Yeah.
And if you're going to go quarterback, it's probably Gardner Minshew over Kyler Murray anyway.
Eh, I mean, I can see the case for Murray over Minshew, but I don't think a quarterback is even in the conversation this year. It's one of those receivers.
Also, as much as we talk about Lamar and, you know, you've got the system around them, there is something to, like, the Arizona offense went from, like, terrible to competent in one season. There is something to Lamar taking an offense and it's built around you and it's great and all that. I mean, there's something to all that. I don't think it's enough for Kyler to win it.
What else? Defense?
The only thing about Defensive Rookie of the Year, Nick Bosa was the right choice there. If you're one of the Raiders fans that's, like, on the Max Crosby bandwagon or whatever, I think our fans are smarter than that, just because he had the same amount of sacks or one more sack than Nick Bosa.
Come on, if you
like, if you're one of the people that has, like, Raiders fans who's like, Max Crosby got screwed, all right, I plead to you to tell your friends to go check out PFF and learn a little bit of nuance about pass rushing and all that stuff. And we love Max Crosby.
That's like the opposite to the optical illusion. Like, these two things, instead of the optical illusion, these two things look different, but they're the same. That's like, these two things look the same, but they're a hell of a lot different. Like, if you think those, that's insane. Nick Bosa was dominant. Matt Crosby was not.
I just encourage you to send people our way to check out Premium Stats 2.0 and look at the grade, the nuance that goes into the grade, the total pressures, the run defense, all the things that go into the reason why Nick Bosa was the right choice. And it wasn't just because the Niners were good and the Raiders are an afterthought and Max Crosby got screwed. Max Crosby's awesome, though. I love him.
Did you know that you remember that trick play the Dolphins ran where the punter threw to the kicker and scored a touchdown or whatever it was? Did you know that that's got a name?
I did not.
It's the Miami Dolphins Mountaineer Shot. Apparently won an award. The Bridgestone Clutch Performance Play of the Year.
Did they win with the Miami Miracle last year, too? Because that was pretty miraculous.
I just, why is this a Mountaineer Shot? What is a Mountaineer Shot? What is any of this?
Maybe they stole it from West Virginia, the Mountaineers.
Oh, yeah? That would make more sense than actual Mountaineers.
Why don't you do some research?
All right. The award that I have a bit of an issue with, Defensive Player of the Year. Here's the thing, right?
Yeah.
We are two reasons Aaron Donald didn't win this award. One, we are judging him this year based off what he did last year. And two, we're getting bored giving the award to Aaron Donald.
I think it's more boredom.
Right? Aaron Donald is still the most dominant defensive player in the NFL. Even though he was not anywhere near as good as he was a year ago. But what you need to bear in mind is what he did a year ago might be one of the best single seasons we have ever seen in the game from a defender, right? He was chasing the sack record as an interior player that's double teamed half the time. That's ridiculous. Like, the fact that he was even doing that is one of the most ridiculous things that's ever happened that shouldn't have happened. It's nuts. So, he took a step back. On the other hand, he was still better than everybody else this year. Like, that's how far ahead of everybody else he was a year ago. He still led all interior defenders this year by about the same amount of pressure as he did a season ago. So we have sacks, hits, and hurries as pressures, right? Total pressures. But we also have this thing that we've mentioned before, these defeated blocks, which are these plays where you win as a pass rusher, you beat your block, but the quarterback gets rid of the ball. He never even knows you're coming, right? The ball's gone before you have a chance to turn that into pressure. Now,
counts as a win for us, essentially.
So you want to reward pass rushers and penalize pass protectors in those plays, but it's not pressure because the quarterback never even knows about it. So we have a way of quantifying that. Now, those are really susceptible to changes in the rest of the defense, right? If you're like coverage versus pass rush thing, if your coverage suddenly sucks, you get a lot of those in the air when you didn't before, right? Coverage is tighter. The quarterback has to hold the ball a bit longer. This year, if you add those plays in, Donald shoots back to the very top of the NFL. Like, total pressures, Za'Darius Smith led the NFL this year, and Aaron Donald was somewhere lower. If you add in those plays, Donald jumps Smith, right? So he was winning, not as much as he was last year, but he was winning more than anybody else on defense. But so many of those plays this year, the ball was gone, and he didn't have a chance to actually impact the pass, but those are still pass rushing wins. He was still dominating his man at the line, but other people around him, the environment thing again, meant that it didn't get to be credited to him.
I pulled these numbers a couple weeks back, and I can't remember the exact thing. I think this was the third best win percentage of his career, last year being the best and the best we've ever seen. And of the best six seasons, I think, for interior defensive linemen, it's like Donald five times and Watt once or something to that effect, right? This was third best that we've ever seen as far as just winning for an interior defensive lineman.
Yeah.
Winning those blocks. So yes, Aaron Donald was overlooked again. And because the Rams didn't have success, we had him with 14 sacks still, right?
Yeah. I mean, he was still somewhere good.
Like, the fact that sacks still move the needle, we had him with 14. I don't know what the official NFL number was.
It was like 10 or something.
The fact that sacks still move the needle, him as an interior lineman, like when John Randall used to do it, an interior lineman used to do it, it was like, whoa, 10 sack season. We had Donald with 14, Cam Hayward with 10, and Jordan Phillips. Sorry, Bills fans, with a very lucky, overrated 10 sacks.
12
for Jordan Phillips.
The NFL.
So 12 and a half sacks for an interior lineman immediately put your name in that conversation. But again, the standard has been
because a year ago, he had 20 and a half, 20.5. So we're like, well, the guy sucked this year. Like, Donald was still the best defender in the NFL.
It's the second highest sack total of his career.
Right. And probably will be until he retires. Yeah. Like, he's the best defender in football. And if we're not giving him Defensive Player of the Year, it means one of two things. Either somebody had an absurd season for the ages, or he got injured. Like, neither of those two things happened. Therefore, Donald was the Defensive Player of the Year.
Donald, Defensive Player of the Year, until he slows down. By the way, wearing our Proper Cloth shirts. We were all over Radio Row with our Proper Cloth. ProperCloth.com/PFF is where you guys can get $20 off your first shirt using the promo code PFF20. Again, you guys are making fun of me for looking good and, you know.
I'm not looking good.
I was looking good and feeling good, and Proper Cloth was there to help.
It felt like you overestimated the dress code of Radio Row.
Listen, I was on TV once a day while I was down there. Now, one time I was on a bike in my, you know, Red Sox workout shirt, but I was on TV multiple times and Proper Cloth made an appearance. Thank you very much.
They did.
On NFL Network.
I mean, the bottom line with the Proper Cloth stuff is being able to go in there and customize every single aspect of the shirt is awesome.
Yes, we love that. Love that. Love being able to get the proper arm length, the proper body fit.
Yes.
Change the collar, change the cuff. Are you going to rock one at a company party this weekend?
Sure. Why not?
Proper Cloth's going to be all over the company party as well. So go check it out. The very best fabric producers in the world. Each one of their shirts goes through extensive quality control testing, so you're getting the absolute best quality and craftsmanship. It's propercloth.com/PFF. Promo code is PFF20 for $20 off your first shirt, which they start as low as $80.
Right.
So you can go get a nice $60 shirt. Please keep sending the photos of your Proper Cloth shirt after you order it. I want to see what your styles look like.
$60 for a fully customizable shirt is insane.
It is. So
I'm just looking at the list of some of these awards, the official NFL ones. Like, they've lent right into this millennial thing. They have a Bud Light Celly of the Year award. The what now? Celly of the year.
Like cell phone?
Celebration, Steve. Come on. Get with the kids.
Celly used to be called a cell phone.
Well, it's not anymore. Things have moved on. By the way, also, did you notice that the halftime show, like it's fully built for people with the millennial attention span of a goldfish.
Right.
Like no song lasted longer than 12 seconds because that's as long as people can focus on anything anymore.
12 second songs. Here's your smorgasbord of songs.
You could get like, if you had like
played 35 songs at the halftime show.
I've kind of been wondering why they keep going to these artists that were big in the 90s. It's because if you go any more recent than that, they run out of their catalog before they finish the show.
That's it.
12 seconds each song. You're out of songs before you're done with the show.
It does always feel like they grab people after their time, huh?
Right. If you started recording in 2005, you don't have enough material for a halftime show.
Here's my 12 song mix and that's all I got.
Right. And I'm out. Right. See ya. It's a 3 minute show. It's ridiculous.
What'd you think of the halftime show? The choreography and some,
it looked
like Shanahan's offense with pre-snap movement.
My brain just can't deal with 10 seconds of a song and then into the next one. I'm like, no.
It just tries to appeal to everybody's nostalgia. I remember those 15 songs. So there it is. There's a line from all of them.
So anyway,
millennial. We can hate on millennials because we're Xennials.
Millennials. What are the next ones?
Gen Z.
There's one more, right? Isn't there one more after that?
I don't know. It's like my kids' generation, right? Our kids' generation.
Sure. There's millennials, generation
or Scout and Z.
I don't know.
Scout Meg Z.
Whatever.
Somebody help us. Where are we right now? It's 2020. What generation?
One more
are we
after that?
It's all a bunch of made up people trying to make a name for themselves with fake generation names. Xennials are still the best. If you're born between 77 and 82,
you can listen to a song for 12 seconds wherever you skip to the next one.
When I was a kid, we used to listen to 2 minute songs.
Can you imagine if you had to, like, if you're in the car listening to music, that was how you had to function? 12 seconds, skip, 12 seconds, skip, 12, skip.
Stop it. Like, our millennials might make up a big chunk of our audience here. Stop.
I'm helping them out. Well, imagine if you're listening to your music like that, if you just let it run for longer than 12 seconds,
you can get into it. There's other good lines in the song besides the first 12.
There are Pink Floyd seconds. Songs where there's no sound before 12 seconds. It's like you barely registered the song started.
Pink Floyd
at that
songs
point.
Are like 2 days in a millennial's
That's
life.
That's what I mean. Like the song has barely even registered noise on the scale after 12 seconds, let alone skip to the next one.
Okay, Boomer.
You see, Boomer was on Radio Row and was saying that the Okay Boomer thing's actually been great for him.
Oh yeah, good
for his work off.
I didn't run into. Did you run into him at all?
I didn't. I saw him on Kevin Clark's Slow News Day thing though.
We had Kev. So last week was a great crossover for a lot of people. We had PFT on our show, which by the way, I think there's a follow up there. PFT really wants to make this fullback assist thing a thing.
Yeah,
and we have the power to do it.
There you go. Ken sent us the generations thing. Gen Alpha is the newest one.
Alpha?
Yeah. That's what
Alpha.
That's what Scout's in 2013 birth start.
Alpha? We'll take her out of it because no.
So they've run out of generations and they've started again, like they used to do with car number plates.
What?
Yeah, they've gone through Gen Z. Now they're back to Alpha.
Well, it's because they started at X.
Yeah, that was kind of stupid.
Alpha. God.
Yeah.
Harry, Teddy, and Benny are Alpha. Oh, that's just going to be a bunch of people. That's just, you know,
listening to 4 second songs and watching 4 second.
No,
videos.
But it's going
to
be like you're your own leader and you, me, like it's the me generation's getting worse and worse now. Now we're Gen Alpha. Everybody's going to think they're I'm alpha male. Alpha male guy.
There's notes on all these generations.
I want to do some research and come back with this.
OK,
it started with the lost generation,
the lost
or the generation of 1914. That's the first one here. Interbellum, the greatest, the silent generation. That's where Gil Brandt came from, right? And all the top 100 players.
Interbellum, that's not a thing.
So my dad was born in the very first year of the baby boomers.
Huh.
My dad is the oldest boomer.
The oldest boomer.
How about that? I can say okay boomer to my dad.
Yeah.
It's great.
Anyway, where were we?
I love that Xennials is in here.
Yeah.
1975 to 1985.
We're a thing.
It's a 10-year generation. Millennials have also gotten Gen Y.
It's interesting.
Gen Next.
Yeah. Xennials essentially has been created just by Xennials,
you know,
who are upset at being lumped into either the idiot categories either side of them. Like the generations either side of Xennials were so bad that we had to craft our own one in the middle.
There is crossover there because millennials were born in 1980.
Yeah.
But Xennials also go to 1985.
So that's what I'm saying. Like, we created our own generation because the two either side of us were so obnoxious, we refused to be part of it.
Yeah, that's what we did. Because I remember rotary phones, and I have a cell phone. That's what makes you a zennial. What? Is remembering, like having to use a payphone, but also now, you know, using technology. We had Nintendo and stuff like that, you know? Huh. That's what makes us zennials. I like the fact that that millennials also have Gen Next named. It feels like they just jumped in and like, no, we want to be called Gen Next. Stop calling us millennials. We're Gen Next.
So this is the description of zennials. The theory goes that zennials dated and often formed ongoing relationships pre-social media. They usually weren't on Tinder or Grindr for their first go at dating, at least. They called up their friends and the person they wanted to ask out on a landline phone, hoping that it wasn't their intended date's parent who picked up.
It's all based on dating?
Apparently, it's all based on phone and dating.
I mean, yeah, I used to talk to my friends on the phone, which was a landline. So that feels like a whole different world.
Well, that was back when you could have a landline before it just got relentlessly spammed by robocalls to the point where you had to unplug it from the wall.
True. Anyway.
Anyway, draft.
You want to wrap this up? 5 minutes on the draft.
5 minutes on the draft.
Maybe 10 to 15, because we're just going today. The NFL draft. It's draft season. Happy draft season. Let's have a party.
Thank you, Steve.
We should have an office party celebrating the beginning of team building season, we'll call it. It's today.
Today.
Let's go break bread at lunch. Celebrate team building season. Huh. Because we got free agency. We have the draft.
So, overview of the draft.
We're going to keep it really thin.
This is.
And then we'll get into more details as the weeks go on.
One of the best receiver groups that's ever come out.
It's really incredible. I do believe. I thought a couple years ago was a great cornerback class that allowed you to cut. So I'm all about, if there's a loaded class, the doubling up theory. If you need corners, double up when they're loaded. If you need receivers, double up. And I'm going to be saying it all draft season. I thought you could have really revamped your secondary a couple years ago with corners. I think this is where, in a playmaker-driven league, where you can hide your offensive line with good playmakers, you can elevate mediocre quarterbacks to have unbelievable production and have top 10 production in a given year because of your playmakers and supporting cast and play callers, this is the draft to attack it with all these different style playmakers as well. They're all good. A lot of them are good. There's speed. There's elusiveness. There's contested catchability. There's route running. There's everything you need at the receiver position in this draft.
I think this receiver draft is also going to make some of the guys picked from a year ago look even worse as well. You know, it's like, he's probably worth the first round pick. And then next year you get like 15 guys that are better than that. And you're like, that maybe if we'd waited a year, that would have been better. But there are some incredible receivers in this draft. Jerry Jeudy in particular from Alabama. It looks insane. The Alabama receiving corps generally, by the way, was just absurd.
Yeah.
Like how they didn't win the national championship just based on that alone.
Henry Ruggs is like sub four three,
right?
Potentially. So right now, PFF wide receiver rankings, we have CeeDee Lamb and Jerry Jeudy sitting at the top. And I would probably put Jeudy. I think Mike Renner, by the way, if you want all the draft details, 2-for-1 drafts is the podcast that's draft all year round.
Well, we're now going into direct competition with them.
We are.
It's a war.
So should we not push them?
Well, I mean,
we'll get Renner. You guys need to listen.
Look,
to
we are still dramatically bigger, so we can throw him a bone here.
Well, you should definitely listen to 2-for-1 drafts as well. Mike Renner and Austin Gale doing a great job doing draft all the time. So Mike Renner has taken over our lead draft analyst spot. I moved on to the AAF and XFL and stuff like that.
You're the XFL guy now? That's starting next week, right?
I know it is. We'll do XFL.
Who's your team?
10 minutes. I haven't looked that closely yet. I'm still hungover from the Super Bowl.
NFL hangover. The New York Guardians. Based purely 100% on the fact that that's the only logo I think I could possibly stomach on anything.
Yeah. I'm just getting over the NFL season. I got to take a look at the rosters and see where.
They got all their logos from clip art.
Oh, I appreciate that.
Yeah.
Did you see I put some paint out there last night.
You put some MS Paint out there?
I did.
What did you do?
I did a little Andy Reid.
Steve is quite the MS Paint artist.
Right there.
That's what you did?
Yeah.
Wow. You wrote Super Bowl champion over the Andy Reid. Los Angeles, the
punt, when he was
passing,
punt, passing, kick when he was 13 and, 6'4", 300.
Yeah.
Whatever he was. Yeah, put Super Bowl champion over it.
Wow. That's
I'm really artistic.
Testing your.
All that said, Mike Renner is on 2-for-1 drafts. We'll have him over here to help promote a lot of the draft stuff that we're doing. He's been ranking these guys all season. currently has CeeDee Lamb number one, Jerry Jeudy number two, but he's been tweeting about, look, this could flip. These guys, this is fluid. Lamb versus Jeudy is close. I would probably lean Jeudy. I have got some concerns, though, with him maybe going over the middle of the field and some of the other things, but Lamb is really good after the catch, has a great feel for defenders. Jeudy is just some of those cuts he makes, man. That's just next level stuff,
right? Speed, route running, quickness, all the things you want to lead off with if you're looking for receivers. Separation.
But you have a guy like Laviska Shenault, who's a little bit bigger bodied. He's explosive, but probably a little bit more on that, possession receiver type of spectrum, which isn't a knock, by the way. That just means you can get open and catch a lot of passes a lot of different ways. You might just not average 16 per catch. Henry Ruggs, as we mentioned, perhaps sub 4.3 type of speed. T. Higgins from Clemson. There's your big bodied 6.4 guy. Jalen Reagor, who's powerful and extremely fast, an undersized type of guy. Guy like Michael Pittman, speaking of big bodied possession type, Michael Pittman Jr., that is. So, I mean, all sorts of different receiver styles and body types in this one.
In Mike's latest mock draft, he has 7 receivers going in the first round.
I think this is one included
Hunter Bryant in that. So 7 receiving options.
This is one where historically you look at the last few drafts and you get a lot of good receivers in rounds 2 and 3, right? You have the Michael Thomases of the world or Juju or all these receivers that maybe are, look at this, you're Terry McLaurin in the third round, AJ Brown in the second round. I always struggle with balancing what's your evaluation versus how much have evaluations just been off through the years. You know what I'm saying? So like when you go into the draft, a lot of teams will do a historical study and say, well, you have to find your tackles in the first round. You have to find your edge defenders in the first round. You can find receivers in the second. How do you balance that historical view of how the NFL has evaluated these players versus your actual evaluations? That's like, I've got 7 first round grades on these guys. Mm-hmm. Or do you have 7, 8, 9 first round grades on receivers and you just inevitably, maybe it's not the biggest positional value. The NFL doesn't think it's high positional value and they're going to wait and then you can get them in the second or third round. Obviously, how do you balance those things?
Obviously, we've just had the Senior Bowl, which is the moment at which I start to look at college players ever.
Yeah.
And we've had this last year, Terry McLaurin stands out. We've had this history of Ohio State receivers that people haven't really been paying attention to suddenly explode and become really good. KJ Hill was a real standout at the Senior Bowl. Again,
because of his route running.
Right,
and
just wrecked people all Senior Bowl long. So as much as we mock it, right, I think there is real value to this idea of dominating the Senior Bowl. What's really cool is that PFF grades the Senior Bowl practices. Obviously, right, we don't get access to NFL practices, the college practices, but we get access to all the tape of the drills at the Senior Bowl, and we grade the practices. And, you know, college, there's always a strength of competition question mark, right? That's why a lot of these guys, when they're scouting, go straight to strength on strength, right? Who's the best competition this guy faced? Let's see how he does there and then work back from that. At the Senior Bowl, in theory, everything is that. It's all an all-star game for everybody. Everybody there should be good. So you get to see how these guys do for an entire week, not just in a game of 50 snaps, but an entire week of drills against all-star competition. And if you are able to consistently beat them, if you're able to consistently win against guys that are all-star level all week long, that I think is a huge boon in your favor. And it's tracked pretty strongly that the guys that dominate Senior Bowl week translate immediately to the NFL level and become good players.
There's, I think, especially at the positions where you can see more one-on-ones, you know, like with a receiver against a DB during the season, you might not see a ton of pure one-on-ones. There's so much off coverage. There's so much zone coverage, so much quarters, cover two, cover three at the college level where you just don't see a whole lot of one-on-one interactions. You get 3 consolidated days of one-on-ones, not just the one-on-ones, but even in the team, you know, 7-on-7 and in the team practices as well. So when you talk about O-line, there's plenty of O-line, D-line interactions throughout the season, but wide receiver, you don't get a ton of that. So I think that's where you can help bridge the gap just a little bit there. I will say this, though. Some of the best corners, like a Christian Fulton, some of the guys that should have been at the Senior Bowl or invited weren't there. So some of the better corners weren't there, and the receivers kind of mopped up.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's not an exclusive thing, right? It's not that anybody that wasn't at the Senior Bowl obviously is not someone to pay attention to. It's just that if a guy puts his hand up and dominates a Senior Bowl week of competition, that's a really good sign for him going forward as a prospect. If you limited yourself exclusively to guys that crush the Senior Bowl, I think you would be in a pretty good spot in terms of picking my guys, you know?
Right. So receivers are loaded.
Yeah.
There's a few decent tight ends in there. I think it's a great place to grab playmakers. I think the offensive tackle class is really good. You've got Andrew Thomas from Georgia, Tristan Wirfs from Iowa.
There's a lot of bad ones in the NFL, right?
Yeah, it's a good time. Jedrick Wills from Alabama. There's a lot of tackle prospects potentially going in the first round. By the way, are you reading off Mike's lead? Is the mock draft on the site? Is it live?
This one is. No, this one's a while old.
Because he just sent
dropped another one.
Are we allowed to discuss? He's got a post-Super Bowl mock.
Oh, I like it.
Can we even discuss what's happening there?
Well, I ask you this. Who's going to stop us?
Who's going to stop us?
Mm.
I'm not going to count all the receivers in that one. But yeah, Mekhi Becton from Louisville. I'm not as high on him. He's a monster, though. 360 pounds. The other interesting storylines, there's two defensive players a lot of people are putting in the top 10. Jeffrey Okuda, the cornerback from Ohio State, and then Isaiah Simmons, the linebacker from Clemson. Simmons is like kind of what we talked about with Derwin James a couple years ago. Like, this is what the NFL needs right now. Derwin has lived up to it. Simmons hasn't graded as well as Derwin did in college, where he literally did everything, could play safety, pass rusher, linebacker, whatever. But Simmons, I have never seen a guy who's like a linebacker by trade straight up line up at free safety and make free safety plays. And he did that in the college football playoff, just like split safety, picks off a pass, that type of versatility. Feels like it has to be used right, doesn't it?
Yeah.
Like, if you just make him a traditional linebacker, you're kind of missing the point.
Well, yeah. I don't know if you're missing the point, but you're certainly wasting the ability, right? Like, what's the point in having a guy that's that good and that versatile if you don't actually take advantage of it? If you just plug him in and say, well, he'll therefore be really good at this spot. I mean, he will, but like, it doesn't feel like it's using 100% of its capability.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, you buy yourself a giant fancy car that can do a whole bunch of stuff, can go 150 miles and you just drive it around like a daily driver and
drive
it
to work.
It's like, I mean, it's good at that, but it feels like it's kind of missing the point, right?
So I think the draft, like the first 15 or so spots, feel like you can really get some difference makers. I've seen a lot. I guess this happens every year with the draft. The back half of the first round mock drafts are all over the place right now. You see some various names. You see, like, Daniel Jeremiah gave the Chiefs a running back. I mean, if you watch last night's game, it's like, why are we ever going to give them a running back? Why are you ever going to draft a running back in the first round anyway? But also, especially with the Chiefs, where they're like, we got Damian Williams. We just made him into a running back, and he's fine. So my point is, the back half of the first round, I think, is going to be all over the place. You see names like Zach Bond from Wisconsin, another really fun, versatile player, hybrid pass rusher, linebacker.
Do you think that's going to change, this idea of not drafting a running back in the first round? Like, it seems that the evidence is getting stronger and stronger that, look, they can be talented players, but it's just not going to matter.
So here's the thing. We only know right now, other than our behind-the-scenes interactions with teams, we only know what the draft media put out there. And I didn't mean Lance Zierlein gave them the running back, I think it was.
Yeah, it was.
And Lance is fine. I mean, Lance does good work, and Daniel Jeremiah.
And the thing is, a lot of them are projecting anyway. So it's like, you know, this is what I think will happen.
Right.
Which is fine. It's not their you know, mistake, if you like, if that happens.
Well, I think teams are going to start getting smarter. The issue is when teams, I think there's a lot of misuse of information out there. I've seen a lot of stuff where it's like, if you want to find a running back, you got to get him in the first round because these first round running backs have been really productive. And that's true. Like, if running backs drafted in the first round, they probably put up really good numbers. But it's another one of those things where it's like, it's because they were given the opportunities. The fact that you can find those running backs later and still give them opportunities and get the same production. The point I was trying to make with the evaluators right now, putting draft boards together and stuff like that, I think we're probably one of the only sites that truly is thinking about team building as we put together our draft board and our mock drafts that are honed toward what we would do, what Mike Renner would do in this draft. So as I'm looking through his mock draft, I don't think we're ever going to see a running back in the first round. We're probably only going to see generational type guards, you know? And we're going to see guys that affect, all I see is guys that affect the pass game. I see quarterbacks, obviously. I see really good pass rushers. I see pass protectors at tackle. I see good interior pass rushers and then safeties and corners and receivers. I mean, guys that can catch pass. It's all pass game driven type of guys. I think other people in draft media are trying to like, oh, this team needs a running back. Let's give them a running back. Mm-hmm. They're not trying to build a team. They're trying to like fill spots on a depth chart that kind of makes sense. That's why Leonard Fournette was picked a couple of years ago.
Yeah.
Hey, the Jags feel strong everywhere. Let's just draft Leonard Fournette.
I think it's just getting interesting that things are definitely shifting in the NFL at the moment towards analytics, data driven. More information is better than less information, all this kind of stuff, to the point where people that mocked it in the past are kind of having to come out now and sort of, you know, at least tacitly say, yeah, okay, we're doing some of this anyway. Now, one of the areas where the evidence is most strong is this concept of running backs being interchangeable. And as good as they may be, as talented as they may be, if you screw with their environment, it doesn't matter. Saquon Barkley couldn't be a better example, right? Guy comes out, he's a generational talent. He's the best running back prospect since Barry Sanders, whatever, right? People were going a long way back to say that this is the best player we have seen in decades. Now, he hits the ground running, fantastic as a rookie. Next year, where's Saquon? Where the production's disappeared. So the whole Todd Gurley, great when things are functioning, disappears when they're not. Zeke Elliott handed the $90 million contract, couldn't carry the team over the line to the playoffs. They, in fact, went away from him. You know, all these kinds of things. Derrick Henry doing nothing until Ryan Tannehill gets into the quarterback position. Suddenly the offense is transformed. There's evidence all over the place that, and then you have, you know, 49ers with the whole running back full of undrafted guys, the Damian Williams, Super Bowl MVP candidate, you know, the evidence could not be stronger that running backs simply are not worth taking high because you can change them in. If the environment is good, they'll be successful. And if it's not, they won't be successful regardless of how talented they are. So given that the rest of the NFL is already sort of heading in this direction of data driven things, I'm curious if we're going to get to a point where teams start actually doing that. Now it's tricky because you only need one, right? Like, you only need one Dave Gettleman to keep drafting a running back at five.
Yeah, I think we're slowly going to move that way. I think there's enough people that misinterpret what's actually happening. Because, again, like, a lot of people looked at last night and, like, you can't tell me running backs don't matter. Look what Damian Williams did. He ran for over 100. He had the 30, you know, the game-winning run and all that stuff. And we're like, that's kind of the point.
Yeah.
Is that he wasn't a first-round pick, and you put him in the game. Like, if Saquon Barkley or Christian McCaffrey was in the Chiefs system, they would be incredible because they're extremely talented, and the opportunities that they would have running into space, catching passes in space, and the way they would be used, their production would be off the charts. But that's the whole point of, if you're going to draft this running back in the first round, Christian McCaffrey, Saquon Barkley, Zeke Elliott, and then you have to say, all we have to do is have an awesome play caller, an awesome offensive line, give them a million opportunities, use them in the passing game, you know, 150 times a year, and then they're going to be good. You know, that's like six caveats before you're getting your value out of that guy. That's the whole point. Versus with another, you could grab another running back in the fourth or fifth round, and even if they get you 90% of the production, that's the point. You can get 90% of that production four rounds later, say, right?
Yeah. I mean, the other issue is they can't carry anything. So even if you can't get that production, you're wasting your time to try and fix that thing before you fix all the other things that affect that thing.
Yeah, I would. So here's the other thing that the analytics guys always seem to go to is that I've learned a lot about. It's more like the study of human behavior when you have these guys, right? So it's not just in a vacuum passes more than run and this and that. It's more the human behavior of when you have Zeke, you feel the need to build the offense around him, or when you have a Derrick Henry and you feel the need to build an offense around him, right? When the best offenses have a running back who is a part of a greater good. The offense is built around the pass game, the receivers, the tight end. And oh, by the way, if you forget about Alvin Kamara, we're going to create mismatches for him and crush you. But that offense is still built around Drew Brees and Michael Thomas and moving the ball in chunks. And then, oh, by the way, here's a mismatch running back that you have to worry about as well. They're a part of a greater whole. They're not built. They're not the offense. The offense isn't built around them. And again, in the running backs don't matter world, which I hate don't matter, but the running backs are somewhat interchangeable. The 49ers are just trotting out anybody in that offense and generally running the ball pretty well until last night. But they're generally running the ball pretty well no matter who the running back is. That's the whole history of the Shanahan scheme. You go from Terrell Davis to the Mike Andersons to Alandis Gary and Warrick Dunn, and they're all productive.
Don't you hate when you tweet something that has a mistake in it and that's the one that takes off?
What'd you do?
Tweeted the Mitchell Schwartz thing and I added up his snaps wrong. And currently 4,600 people have liked it with a mistake in it.
So you just go right under a little asterisk.
I did. I replied to it.
Did you? I had my, did you put your sound? Yeah, everybody puts their little SoundCloud in there. That's like the joke.
Oh yeah.
You have a viral tweet and you have linked to your SoundCloud. I said my SoundCloud yesterday on my viral tweet with the dance move was PFF 30. The promo code. Is it going away today? 30% off all PFF annual products.
I don't know.
Today's generally the last day, but you know what? If you just keep, so you get till the end of the day here Monday, if you're watching live on YouTube, or if you're listening to the podcast here on Monday, PFF 30 to the end of Monday, you get 30% off your annual products, which of course, Sam, means how much access do you get? How many days?
366.
If you wait a month, you're going to lose a day of access on your annual subscriptions.
Yeah.
You're going to lose a whole day. So we get 366 days of access because of a leap year. I'm pretty sure that's how it works, right? The system knows. It's going to cancel on the or renew on the same date next year, right?
Are you now not even sure now that you've...
Of course it is. 366 days of access. PFF 30. 30% off your PFF annual subscriptions. Go check it out. Super Bowl grades will be out shortly. Our guys are reviewing them right now. And we're going to have XFL stuff. You're going to be sitting here a week from now watching XFL saying, you know what? I want XFL grades. It'll all be in there.
I'm going to tell a quick basketball-related story. Basketball/Super Bowl/... comedy injury.
Yeah, then we'll wrap it up.
So, I think pretty sure I broke my finger playing basketball last Monday, preparing for this tournament.
Just like you broke your rib.
I think there's a pretty good chance this is actually broken.
Yeah, man.
Anyway, so broke it on the Monday. Obviously, we're getting on a plane that evening heading to Miami. So, you know, tape it up, whatever. It's fine. Then get to Miami. Now it's starting to turn like black and getting bad, right?
Yeah.
Blue and black. And this is my ring finger, right? So I had a wedding ring on. We're getting pretty swollen at this point, to the point where I'm now starting to get concerned about needing to cut it off, lest it, you know, cut off circulation in my finger and the
your finger
drop off.
Oh, the ring.
Cut the ring off
in order
to release the pressure on the finger so that the finger doesn't drop off. So we're sitting at dinner at some Italian restaurant. And I'm getting like progressively more concerned about how tight this ring is and, you know, really cutting off circulation of the finger. Decide that, look, I don't want to have to take a trip to a Miami ER in order to cut off a wedding ring.
Right.
But the knuckle is swelling to the point where this is not an easy removal job. So what do? You grab the olive oil at the table. You put it all over the finger and then wrench the thing off and liberate the finger from the freedom or from the constriction that was the ring. That was one of the most painful things I've ever had to do, but it freed my finger for it to turn black all by itself, ringless. Ring went in the pocket, all protected and safe.
You did save it, right?
But now there is like literally no way that goes back on this finger. Like this finger I've broken in the past.
Yeah, you have to let it go down a little bit.
And its knuckle, like the knuckle on this finger is thicker than the one on this finger because this one is broken, right? This is like significantly wider than the one on this finger now.
My two ring fingers are forever swollen from that. Yeah.
Well, that is...
It's not like booger distorted stuff.
Did you see Tori Holt's picture?
No.
So Tori Holt has a booger finger, but it's his middle finger, right? So it was like, for all those people that think Tori Holt shouldn't be in the Hall of Fame, it was Tori Holt doing this, except this finger shoots off like this.
That's great.
Wait, let me find that. That's amazing.
Good job, Tori.
Stall, because you need to see this.
Just what a week last week, though. The content that we got, our group, we chatted with Mina Khan. That's we did. That looks fake.
That's his finger.
That looks fake.
There's no way they're going to be able to see that, right?
Hang on, let me go.
You can see it.
Let me go.
We'll get it.
All right, here comes Tori Holt. Sam's showing our podcast, folks. Oh, you guys should listen to the pod, our YouTube folks.
Tori Holt flipping people the crooked finger.
Francis is upset that we're not talking about football. The football discussion's over, Francis.
The podcast is over.
I'm sorry. The podcast is over.
So
we're just finishing it with a fun story. But last week was a lot of fun between Mina Kimes, PFT. We got Booger. We tracked down Booger in his hotel. Mike Shanahan sat down and talked with us. Tom Curran, New England insider. Look, disgusting.
There you go.
Tom Curran discussing Tom Brady's future. A lot of great stuff on the YouTube channel, on social media. Jeff Schwartz, Greg Cosell. We got to have both of those guys back on. You know, we extended the olive branch to O-line Twitter through Jeff. So a lot of good discussion there. Just a great week down in Miami at the Super Bowl. And yeah, that was fun.
Mm-hmm.
Good Super Bowl. We'll be back Thursday.
Where's the next one?
Super Bowl next year.
Where's the next?
Tampa.
Tampa?
It's going to be next year, about a year from now.
That's less fun.
Tampa's not bad. It's all right. So Tampa next year. We'll be there. Right? I think. We'll be there.
To be determined.
TBD. I think we'll be there. Anyway, rest of the week. So Thursday, the PFF 101 is coming out throughout the week. The top 101 players in the NFL.
Starting today.
Regardless of position, besides fullbacks and kickers, starting today. We'll be counting down at PFF.com. We'll break down the PFF 101 on Thursday, and we'll just continue our draft discussion, link it to teams. It's all draft season and free agent season starting now. All right, so hit us up again. More topics on what you guys want to hear throughout team building season and the off season. And that's it. We're out. See you guys Thursday. Quick break to tell you guys about NFL Game Pass, the only way that you can replay every game all season long. You can relive all the gutsy calls, crazy catches, wild comebacks, and breakout stars from every game every week. It's all the action, all the football you can handle, all in one place. So every game that we're talking about right now, you guys can rewatch it after the fact. I'm going to be going back, and you guys can too. Go check out Lamar Jackson in week one. Go check out Dak Prescott and what that Cowboys offense actually did. Go check out Kyler Murray and his NFL debut. That's my favorite thing about NFL Game Pass. You can go back and watch at any time. And if you haven't watched a condensed game yet, you have to try it out. It's every play from the game back to back to back, so you can replay an entire NFL game in the fraction of the time it normally takes. It's how I'm able to follow all the MVP candidates, all the breakout stars, and of course your waiver wire pickups all season long. To see all the action this season and stay on top of all the big storylines, you need NFL Game Pass. Best of all, you can kick off the 2019 NFL season with a 7-day free trial of NFL Game Pass. Just sign up now at NFL.com/ProFootballFocusNFL.